This is All Things New Orleans here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans, 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux, Houma. Thanks for joining us this Thursday. I'm Tegan Wendland. Today, we'll talk about how online fundraising has changed the nature of disaster relief efforts. We'll also have an interview with the author of an investigative story on migrant workers in the Gulf of Mexico. And Jack Hopke joins us with an interview on the city's premier annual music events. But we'll start today's show with a look at short-term rentals. Love them or hate them, short-term rentals are booming in New Orleans. On October 6th, the city council is expected to make its first vote on regulating them. It's working with rules proposed by the City Planning Commission. One of the biggest points of contention is whole house rentals. Many locals say that when short-term visitors rent whole homes, it changes neighborhoods. Eileen Fleming reports.
Patricia Gay is the executive director of the Preservation Resource Center. The group is dedicated not only to saving historic architecture, but maintaining the feel and fabric of neighborhoods. She says much of New Orleans' appeal is its authenticity.
The tourists who come here are fascinated with our neighborhoods.
So it makes sense they would jump at the chance to have the neighborhood experience their own New Orleans house for a few days. But
a neighborhood without neighbors is not a neighborhood.
The PRC sent an email blast asking people to oppose whole home rentals. Leonard Baudouin of the Broadmoor Improvement Association agrees.
We have a really strong neighborhood, and we're all about neighborhood pride and diversity in the neighborhood, and we want to maintain that by continuing having residents, long-term residents in the area.
He's a lifelong resident in New Orleans and helps people coming into Broadmoor find affordable housing. He says after Hurricane Katrina, a two-bedroom unit rented for about $800 a month. Now it's almost $1,300. The Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance also opposes whole house rentals. It says they've made the post-Katrina housing shortage worse. These arguments irritate Alex Ramirez. The 32-year-old bought his first home in 2010, a double in Lower Mid-City. 2 years later, he bought an adjacent property, fixed it up, and tried to find a long-term tenant. He couldn't. So he listed it on websites like Airbnb and HomeAway and started making money. Since then, he's bought and fixed up several more homes on the block and puts them to work as short-term rentals.
It's not about corporate America or gritty corporate America coming in here and buying up all these properties. It's about the small business owner being able to leverage tools like HomeAway or Airbnb and being able to put their own names out there and competing with the big guys.
He lives nearby with his wife and baby, and his mom and dad work in the company. He says his properties have improved the neighborhood. But in the St. Rock neighborhood, residents met last weekend to rehearse a protest march against whole home rentals. Brian Luckett bought his home in the Bywater 20 years ago for $40,000. A few years ago, he noticed whole homes vacant during the week and full on weekends with new people. He says this type of short-term rentals has made the neighborhood quieter, but he misses the bustle and socializing with long-term residents.
Fortunately, right on either side of me, I have terrific neighbors, longtime neighbors, and, you know, they look out for me and I look out for them, and I'm really glad they're there.
Far from a grassroots second line, Airbnb is conducting a $1 million media campaign ahead of the planned council vote. Its ads focus on middle-class people who make extra money with Airbnb. But those ads don't make a distinction between renting a room in a house or the whole house, with the owner perhaps off-site. The San Francisco-based company says of its 4,100 or so hosts in New Orleans, at least 3,000 are whole home listings. Asked if the company would drop the whole home option, Airbnb spokesman Chris Lehane also didn't distinguish between types of rentals.
The vast majority of our hosts in New Orleans are really doing this as supplemental income. They're not doing this as their full-time commercial activity. We also know that there's a significant chunk of people in New Orleans who really do depend on this income to make ends meet.
In its proposed rules, the City Planning Commission recommended that whole home rentals only be allowed 30 days a year, letting owners make some money during major tourism events like Jazz Fest and Mardi Gras. New rules would allow owners unlimited rental nights for parts of their home or for property in commercial areas with permission from the City Department of Safety and Permits. But the mayor's office put the whole home option back in the proposed ordinance, saying all options should be in play for discussion by the council. For WWNO, I'm Eileen Fleming.
And now we head to Baton Rouge. Like any major disaster, when floods hit South Louisiana last month, big relief organizations streamed in, and people all over the world gave money. But it's no longer just the big brand names of philanthropy that attract donations from afar. Crowdfunding has grown up, and now millions of dollars are funneled to small and specific causes, and that's changed flood relief around Baton Rouge. Rhiannon Swear loves cats, which is good, since she's got more than 20 in her small Baton Rouge apartment. She takes me into a room where a handful of kittens sleep on a bed and tackle each other on the floor.
Just look at them. Look at these guys. They like to sleep and eat. They lay around. They're my spirit animal.
Before she moved to Baton Rouge, she used to be a vet tech in Los Angeles. She heard that a few local animal shelters were flooded and called some friends to go pick up cats that would otherwise be euthanized. Cat litter and toys are all over the floor.
They're roommating with our guinea pigs right now.
Can't let them out. Her 7-year-old son likes sleeping with 4 kittens in the room. Her husband, Brandon, not so much. A sign on the door says, Cat Hotel, Brandon's Nightmare. Swear has a DIY adoption process to find homes for the cats. She's paid for all the cat litter, food, shots, and other stuff with a GoFundMe page. It's raised about $1,000.
We're not entirely paycheck to paycheck, but we're close enough that, like, yeah, we definitely couldn't afford to feed, like, an extra 12 cats, you know, if we needed to. Because that's on top of the 5 that are our cats.
It's been mostly people she knows around the country, people who may not have given to general flood relief efforts, but wanted to help her with this project. Online campaigns like GoFundMe match donations and services to the exact people or animals who need them. The idea is to eliminate the inefficiency of larger organizations. There are thousands of flood-related causes like Swear's on GoFundMe. There's one for police officers, one for employees of Massage Envy, even one for a bobcat refuge. Some have videos.
I didn't want my wife to clean a lot of the heavy stuff. She's pregnant right now, and the kids are now in my still in my brother's house.
Search for Louisiana floods on GoFundMe, and a strange universe of needs pops up. Adult children who've set up a page to help their elderly flooded out parents. Who do they expect to donate? It's hard to tell. Probably mostly people they know. They've raised maybe a few $100. But then there's the occasional individual homeowner who somehow got $10,000 in donations.
There is a potential for those who are more socially savvy, marketing, where they're the ones who are attracting the funding.
Key Liu is an expert in disaster management at Tulane University. He says a downfall of crowdfunding disaster relief is how subjective it is.
Are those resources spent according to those who are in most need? If somebody puts forward an argument that they have lost their home, they are in need of immediate cash assistance, I think it's a wonderful mechanism in the short term. But in the long run, we don't see these funding mechanisms supporting long-term recovery.
And that may not seem like a big deal when you're talking about a few thousand dollars here and there, but he points to an online campaign that raised $2.5 million after Hurricane Sandy.
We're talking about real serious dollars here, where we do need some regulations.
Regulations or relationships with the big charities who ideally have a bigger picture of a whole community's needs after disaster. But recent scandals and critiques of, say, the Red Cross are driving the interest in crowdfunding disaster relief. With crowdfunding, Lou says there's a risk people could take the money and run and not help anyone. But when crowdfunding's at its best, he says it helps people get money fast. After Katrina, he says fast cash could have made a big difference.
What we would have seen would be the ability for, let's say, individual businesses to be able to get funding to support, to keep them moving forward, versus waiting for the formal authorities to be able to do their assessment, waiting for that money to finally become available. And at that point in time, it's too late to recover.
Rhiannon Swear, who saved all those cats, heard people with flooded homes worry about how long it would take to get FEMA money. So she helped a few do a GoFundMe.
It's been pretty imperative, especially for, like, getting the ball rolling.
They may not raise much or anything with crowdfunding, but why not give it a try? I'm Tegan Wensland, and you're listening to All Things New Orleans here on 89.9 WWNO. Deepwater Horizon, the action thriller about the 2010 BP oil spill, is coming out this week. The movie details the conditions workers faced on the rig. It was shot in South Louisiana and even cast some current and former oil workers. We all know the story of the rig blowout and the workers who died, but there are accidents on offshore rigs all of the time, and there's a whole population of workers we never hear about. Freelance reporter Justin Noble is wrapping up an investigative story for the online magazine Take Part about the conditions migrant workers face in the Gulf. His article starts with a much lesser-known rig explosion in 2012 at a Black Elk platform and the workers whose lives were lost there. So, Justin, your article argues that the oil industry is really exploiting foreign workers and there are these rampant safety violations and unsafe living environments. Who are these people? Where do they come from? And why are they choosing to work here in the Gulf of Mexico?
These workers are coming from the Philippines, a country in the far western Pacific. They have a really poor economy, and 1 in 10 people in the Philippines works abroad. And currently, 6,000 people a day are leaving the Philippines to work abroad. So you do have a situation where this population is desperate for work, even work that may be abusive to them. And still, time and again, they often make the decision to take a job when they know there are abuses, just because it's will at least provide some money that they can send back to their families.
One of the examples in your story was about conditions at the Black Elk platform when it set fire in 2012, killing several workers at that time. So tell us about the conditions in terms of safety.
So when these workers were not working offshore, they were living in a bunkhouse. This bunkhouse used to be a bowling alley. They were given these dormitory rooms. They're small windowless rooms. They have a bed. There's bathrooms down the hall. But the abuses start to arise when you learn that the doors are locked at 10 p.m. They're under 24-hour-a-day video surveillance in that bunkhouse. They cannot leave the bunkhouse alone without supervision. So even, say, to go to Walmart, if they try, and in some instances workers try to just walk to the grocery store by themselves, they were threatened with deportation. Another worker happened to fall in love with someone who worked at Grand Isle Shipyard. They intended to get married. That worker was threatened with deportation if he continued with the marriage. So the workers were really curbed from having any sort of existence beyond this job. Furthermore, they were forced to do jobs that they weren't actually hired to do. For example, wash the car of the boss, help scrape paint in a restaurant co-owned by their boss, pick up clothes that had blown away in the wind after a storm. And then we get to the offshore setting, and the issue that really arises is the offshore oil industry is a very dangerous industry. We learned that, of course, in Deepwater Horizon. Literally one errant spark can explode a massive platform and spew more than 100 million gallons of oil, kill 11 people. So it's dangerous. There's a lot of safety regulations that rely on workers to express concern. They have what's called the Stop Work Authority. If you think there's a problem, say something. Except these workers were time and again encouraged to really just keep their heads down, not say anything to their supervisors. Again, there were instances when the workers mentioned concerns to their supervisors. They were threatened with deportation. They were threatened that they would lose their jobs with the company.
So how many workers are we talking about here? I mean, are they employed on every single rig or just a handful?
This particular company, Grand Isle Shipyard, between the years of 2006 to 2013 at least, they were bringing in between 100 and 200 Filipino workers a year. And they did work on some of the major rigs. And this is there in their testimony. They worked on BP's Mad Dog platform, which is a massive platform. They worked on Shell's Ursa platform. They also worked on some of these smaller platforms like the Black Elk platform. And so we know of these abuses because many of these workers ended up filing a lawsuit. They testified, sworn testimony, and stated what they were experiencing.
Are the oil companies really complicit in hiring these migrant workers? Don't they know who they're hiring, and how does that work?
It's a complicated process. So a company like Grand Isle Shipyard, based in Galeana, Louisiana, they will have a system of labor recruiters over in the Philippines. And that company might have a couple agents that go out into the countryside or go out into poor parts of a city looking for people who need work, looking for people who are skilled welders but are out of work or need work. And then they will then partner with a U.S.-based company, which is in connection with the Philippine company and also in has contacts within the U.S. State Department and knows how to pass knows how to get the appropriate information on the visa, and so they will arrange for these visas. So you have this tricky chain of contractors where the actual company that does the offshore oil service work is contracting with one or even two companies that thread back to the Philippines, and then that company, Grand Isle Shipyard, is actually, they do contract work for another company, for Black Elk, who actually operated this platform that ended up exploding.
Thank you, reporter Justin Noble, for talking to us today about your article.
Thank you so much, Tegan.
In lighter news, we're now joined by our old friend, Saturday Night Jazz host Jack Hopke, who joins us to share a visit with the principals who put together one of the city's premier annual music events.
All right, what we have here is some shameless jazz promotion with my very good friends, I am so happy to say, Missy Bowen and Jason Patterson. Missy from the University of New Orleans Music Department.
Yep.
Jason Patterson, majordomo at Snug Harbor here and also involved in various other jazz activities around town, have okay. come with us today to initiate, at least in a news fashion, the forthcoming Jazz at the Sandbar series for 2016-17.
Hallelujah.
Here at the University of New Orleans. You guys get together to help put this thing together, and it works as a very effective team as it has for the past several years here. Now, we start this coming Wednesday.
That's correct.
And we have a tradition of beginning with Ellis Marsalis.
Absolutely. And why stop now? For those that are not initiated, Ellis was the endowed chair of the Jazz Studies Department here at UNO for many wonderful years. And he, I was going to say graduated, he retired in 2001. And so ever since, we've been asking him to come back and visit us on campus, you know, and show us how it's done. So he's going to be there with Victor Atkins' Hot Shots, they're called.
Mm-hmm. That's two great pianists right there.
Yeah. Maybe they'll do a dueling kind of thing there.
They also, I want to get into some of the purposes of this program because we involve students, Missy, do we not, on these performances?
This is one of the cool things about this program. When Ellis first started it, his goal was to match our student combos with seasoned professionals to get them learning how to act on the bandstand, what's etiquette, how to introduce the band. Some of these things that, you know, you go to the combo, you go to the rehearsal, you're kind of in this little insulated world. When you're up on the stage, it's different. You're looking out at an audience and having to communicate with the guest artist. So Jazz at the Sandbar was born with that premise, and it's evolved. We bring in some, of course, worldwide talent. This year, well, we get to the schedule, but somebody like Ellis Marsalis. So our student groups will play with him. The standard format is it's either one or two groups each evening. This first round on the 5th of October will be Victor Atkins' combo. So it will be five or six students who he has been teaching, and they will perform with Ellis for both sets starting at 7, and they're pretty prompt. And then the second set usually starts about 8:30.
A little more general information about this wonderful series. It takes place at the Sandbar, which is over across the street from us here.
Yes, the whole complex is called The Cove. Okay. And a wonderful complex it is. They just took the guts out of the original frame of that building and did a great, great job with it.
Yes, a very comfortable venue.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful, and the UNO Alumni Association really stepped up. You know, it sort of languished after the federal floods. And when we came back, I want to say 2003 was sort of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, was very triumphant, and the facility is beautiful. We were given really carte blanche in terms of a sound system, setting up, you know, how we wanted the stage to look and feel. So it's a very friendly environment. You know, they got the food, they got the drink, they got all that stuff.
It is also an easy venue to access parking-wise.
Oh, yeah, completely.
And financially, we don't talk prices here on public radio, but it costs next to nothing to go to these performances.
Every season, we have a couple of alumni from the program, success stories, as you would. Mm-hmm. And then we have some veteran folks, and then we always do specialty genres like world music. We always have, like this year we have Jovino Neto coming, a brilliant Brazilian pianist.
Indeed.
That's going to be playing with Ricky Sebastian's world beat combo.
Ricky on the drums.
How did you know that?
A trumpeter on the schedule, a pianist, a saxophonist, a guitarist. We do mix it up nicely.
Yeah.
And you did speak about mentoring. Who better than Ellis and perhaps Hank Mackey to represent that aspect of what you do?
Hank's combo has been performing on these things for years and years. This is the first time that we actually have Hank as a guest. Why, you might ask? Because he's retiring from the UNO program.
After having taught virtually every guitarist in town.
Something
much.
Like that. I think everybody's had Hank.
They all acknowledge him as the man.
We started working on Ingrid Jensen, for example, maybe a year or so ago. And mm-hmm. it worked with her touring schedule this fall. And so we're very lucky to have her. And then we close out our program with Aaron Goldberg. Hi.
Well, he's been on the scene for a long, long time, and he's always been consistently in demand in New York for years. You know, it takes a while, but we try to get these very busy artists to come down and visit us. And, you know, Aaron's got history down here, so he loves coming down and playing.
And in terms of locals, one of the names we haven't mentioned, Tony DeGraudy, is on the schedule this year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Tony DeGraudy, of course, from Astral Project, and a UNO alum also on the saxophone who will be our second show on the 12th, Kari Allen Lee, who has been making a name for himself in various recordings and public performances and films. And
yeah, Kari takes it to another level.
Yeah.
I mean, he's so open and giving of his playing. He's an educator over at NOCA now. And they are a six-piece, and one of the pieces in the band is a visual artist.
It's truly special. We have a good crowd of regulars, and I think we also enjoy watching the students change and grow over a semester, over a show, over a semester, over a year, where, you know, somebody will stand up and be terrified to sing, and then by April, they're doing it. They're owning it. So, you know, those kinds of things. And that's what makes this series unique.
This is Jazz at the Sandbar. It's coming up, starts next week. It happens every Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
And
7 p.m. It's an early start time. You can bring your kids. It's very family friendly.
Jason, thank you for the work you do in bringing these brilliant musicians together. Missy, thank you for representing the University of New Orleans and providing their support. That's Missy Bowen and Jason Patterson. Jazz at the Sandbar starts next week, and we're all pretty darn excited.
Well, thanks so much for having us, Jack.
Thanks,
Jack. It's always fun coming to visit you.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jack.
Schedules and other information can be found at nojc.org/sandbar and the UNO website. Since 2011, NOLA to Angola has been uniting people in a 170-mile solidarity bike ride from municipal court in the shadow of Orleans Parish Prison to Angola Prison. And that solidarity extends way beyond the miles trekked on the ride. The ride focuses on bringing people together, no matter what barriers separate them. Kelly Crawford has the story.
We're here today with Katie Hunter-Lowry, one of the organizers of NOLA to Angola. So, Katie, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks so much.
How would you describe the impact that NOLA to Angola has?
NOLA to Angola is currently Cornerstone Builders Bus Project's main source of funding. So Cornerstone runs free buses for friends and family of incarcerated folks to go visit their loved ones. This is especially crucial around the holidays. It's especially crucial for people who don't have funds to travel on their own. For so long, income and economics have been a barrier to connecting folks on the inside to folks on the outside. So that means phone calls, that means visitation, that means sending money to spend in the commissary. So these rides are crucial to keep families connected with the people that are still part of their family unit. They're just physically separated for a little bit of time or a long period of time. So the money that we raise each year is absolutely instrumental to Cornerstone's operations and the lives that they're able to impact. So it's really wonderful to be able to be an organization that supports a really specific and dedicated mission of a group that is part of the community, knows what they're doing. It's really a chance for mostly white folks to be actual allies and to extend to our communities and say, listen, this might not be an issue that impacts your life, but it is an issue that impacts lots of communities, and here is how you can be an actual real support.
Yeah, right, which is fantastic. So what information about NOLA to Angola or the Cornerstone Builders Bus Project would you like covered that usually never gets covered?
I think that the idea that this project really can be a model could be a model for so many different places and for so many different ideas, right? It's truly a way to raise money and connect communities that may have more access to wealth to issues or ideas that don't normally affect them, but maybe they know someone who knows someone who does. So there's so many different components where our riders are able to reach out to their communities, whether they're here, whether they're across the states or worldwide, and bring this issue to their attention. Meanwhile, in addition to talking on the ride about reform of prisons and justice that way, we're also talking about environmentalism. We're also talking about cycling. We're talking about the history of Louisiana. There's a real intersectionality there that I think is what makes it such a great experience for everyone.
Yeah. So tell us about Leo Jackson.
Leo is amazing. He is a minister, Minister Leo Jackson. He's been with Second Zion Baptist Church for 8, going on 9 years. In addition to the Cornerstone buses, he also has a work release program for recently released folks, and he mentors children of incarcerated parents. He works so hard and is so inspiring while being incredibly sweet and humble. He spent 32 years in Angola, so his connection to that place is, you know, ever present in those ways. And he got released and immediately started giving back in ways that he saw gaps.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. What do the riders experience when they arrive at Angola prison?
The ride intentionally goes to Angola during the month of October because that is when the Angola prison rodeo is happening. So that is the time of year that the public is let into the prison grounds. We don't attend the rodeo, but we absolutely encourage riders to head into the craft fair to talk to folks who are selling their wares and do what you feel is a completion to the miles that you just rode. What will you get out of the conversations with people who make some of the only money they're going to make that year at the craft fair? We have riders who have pen pals who can go specifically find their pen pal and catch up with them in person or take other riders and introduce them. We have a good relationship with the Angolite, the newspaper at Angola, and always stop and chat with those guys. And it's a lot. There's a lot of emotions to walk into a space after what's been a really exhausting couple of days, knowing that you get to walk out and leave and so many of these people don't. And it's a lot to think about and a lot to talk about.
Yeah, a lot to take in. I can't even imagine. To find out more about NOLA to Angola, you can check out their website, nolatoangola.org, look them up on Facebook, or check them out on nolav.com or wwno.org. And thanks so much, Katie, for coming in.
Thank you.
For NOLA V and WWNO, this has been Kelly Crawford and
Katie Hunter-Lowry.
And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. Thanks for joining us here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans, 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux, Houma. I'm Tegan Wendland. Until next week, take care.